And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Janet F. from Grover Beach.
Hi everybody, my name is Janet Flores and I am an alcoholic.
Hi Janet.
Good to be here, it's good to be sober. I actually consider myself a fortunate alcoholic. And usually before I begin to talk, I did meditate and pray today, but I always like to call on my higher power and use the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. So I'm going to read that if you indulge me. Says the Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there's discord, harmony. Where there is error, truth. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen.
Amen.
You know, I try to remember these words, you know, love, pardon, harmony, truth, faith, hope, light, because joy and love, you know, that's what I seek, you know, today. And that wasn't always what I sought after, or I did, but maybe all in the wrong places. I always also like to start, before I get into my pitch, is in the big book on page 280, it talks about it talks about the stories, right? And the stories go in sections that are, if you haven't read the book, you'll know that it starts with some of the worst cases, and then it goes on to the stories about the people who said they stopped in time. And I always identify with this part of the book. I would say if I had my story in the book, it would be in this section. So I'm going to read you a little bit of the introduction, and I'm going to insert I instead of they, so that it gives you a better understanding. It says, among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with deliriums, with hospitals, with asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there had been occasional serious episodes, but with many, drinking had been little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost either health, business, family, or friends. They realized, or I could say I realized that repeated lack of drinking control, when I really wanted control, was a fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This plus mounting emotional disturbances convinced me that compulsive alcoholism already had me, that complete ruin would be only a question of time. And then it goes on and it says, I have been saved years of infinite suffering. I didn't wait to hit bottom because, thank God, I could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit me. That sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I start my story, because I didn't come here to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought I had a problem or because I felt like my life was ruined. I came because I got a job working in the field of alcoholism. And that was the only job I could find, because that wasn't my chosen career. Prior to that, I had been a teacher that I got pink slipped from. I had been working with different areas, and I had voluntarily quit and told them to shove their job up their ass. I mean, you know, you can imagine the attitude I had, right? I don't know why they didn't keep me working there. Begged me to come back, you know. And I couldn't find a job, but I convinced these people who were looking for an alcoholism counselor that I had the credentials, I had the degree, I could speak Spanish, because they needed a bilingual person. And back in, before I guess I should know, this I'm my sobriety date is May 11th, 1985. So I was 31 when I got here. You know, that was a long time ago, 71 now. So back then, there were not a lot of bilingual counselors. And so I told them I'm a quick study, and if you hire me, I'll learn what I have to learn, and I do what I have to do, and they said, okay. So I went to UC San Diego, and I got my certificates, and you didn't need much back then to be an alcoholism counselor. And I got on the job. And it was then that I really learned about alcoholism. And it was part of the program that I worked for. They wanted me to take the clients to AA meetings. So I go, okay, I'm going to sit here in the meetings with them, you know. I come around and go, I'm Janet, I'm observing. And everybody would do exactly what you guys did right now. They'd laugh, you know. I'm like, well, why are they laughing? And I used to sit around the Alana Club, and the old timers would say, well, do you drink a lot? And I'm like, I just drink on weekends. And, you know, and I'm just a social drinker. And part of my job was to read this big book and to read the 12 by 12. And so when I read the big book, I was like, well, I do a lot of those things. And I could hear you guys talk about the stuff that happened in your life. And I'm like, I've done that. That's happened to me, you know. And I didn't ever think that alcohol was that big of a problem for me. I knew I had problems, but I didn't think that I had problems because I drank. I thought I drank because I had problems, you know, and I started realizing by listening to you guys that maybe I could be an alcoholic. But then I read the book, and it describes different drinkers. Well, one of the drinkers it describes is the heavy drinker, and the heavy drinker can quit when they have a sufficient reason. And I go, oh, that's me. I'm a heavy drinker, but I don't have a sufficient reason to quit. And thus I kept drinking, even though I was working in a field, you know. I was working in the field, and I was still drinking, and I was still going out on weekends. And the board of directors, I created a program, because the program that I was working for, to me, wasn't sufficiently meeting the needs of the people that I needed to work with, the Spanish-speaking people. So I created my own program, and I had a board of directors that I handpicked. And they asked me if I could consider not drinking in public because the clients were saying that they saw me at the club and they saw me that I fell down on the floor. So what was I going to tell them? No, I can't do that. And I said, well, of course, I don't need to drink. I don't need to drink. And well, what I started doing is drinking at home by myself, you know. And I started seeing more and more of the symptoms that you guys all talked about. And I'm like, no, I can't be an alcoholic. You know what? I need to stop drinking. I have a sufficient reason now. You know, my job, sufficient reason to stop drinking, right? Not the fact that I had, you know, gotten, when I was in college, you know, wrecked my car in Tijuana because I couldn't see the lines on the road when I was driving with one hand over my eye, you know, and almost killed the passengers that were with me. And ended up spending 3 days in jail in Tijuana, you know. My solution to that was, I'm not drinking tequila in Tijuana anymore. No more. Tijuana is just not the place for me to drink tequila. You know? You know, I didn't think I had that big of a problem, you know. But then upon analysis, I started realizing that alcohol was taking a toll on me. I was like, waking up with people going, who in the fuck is that? You know? And what it was doing to me was breaking down my moral character. You know, I was doing things that I would later feel ashamed and embarrassed about. I was demoralizing myself, and I was feeling guilty, and I was feeling, you know, my self-esteem was just like lowering. Even though, you know, in the eyes of some people, you know, well, I had a master's degree, and I'm bilingual, I'm a woman, I'm in, by this time I'm directing this program, I'm the executive director, and I had gotten funding for a women's recovery home. So I was running an outpatient program and a women's recovery home. And I decided I need to stop drinking. But I don't need AA. I can stop on my own, because I'm just a heavy drinker, and I have a sufficient reason now. But when I try to stop is when I found myself unable to maintain that level of dryness, because I wasn't sober, you know. As soon as something happened that I didn't like, as soon as I got told no, or I didn't get what I wanted, because I was really immature, but I didn't know that, I would seek out to have a good time, and that always meant drinking, you know. And so eventually, I just came to the conclusion that I had that epiphany. I was driving home, and I had been dating this guy in L.A., and he told me I couldn't meet his mother. And I'm like, God, I've been dating you for 3 months, and I can't meet your mom. You know? How? Because, us alcoholics, we're already going to get married and have kids and move into the big house, and, And all he wanted was to spend time with his mom by himself. She was coming from another country, and I came home, and I was like muttering to myself about how, I guess I'm just, I'm just nothing. He doesn't want me to meet his mom, I'm just not good enough, whatever, all this talk. And he had given me a bottle of liqueur to give to my sister, that bottle of liqueur never made it to her. She doesn't know to this day that he had gifted her that. I stopped to get a cup of coffee, and just like Jim in that book, big book, where he puts the whiskey in the milk, I got off at a Denny's, and I said, I was driving back from L.A. to Bakersfield, and I said, can I have a cup of coffee? She goes, yeah. And I go, I'm going to go to the bathroom, I'll come back. I come back, and she goes, you still want that coffee? And I said, give me a cup of ice. Instead, I got the cup of ice, I got the liqueur, because my mind was going, well, he said it's just like ice cream, it's not really alcohol, and I got the liqueur and I poured it in the cup of ice. It's not going to really do anything to me. By the time I got to Arvin on Highway 99, I was buzzing. I hadn't drank for like 3 months, so, it got to me. And I look in the rearview mirror, and there is those cop lights. And of course, he's after me. I got paranoid. Oh my God, I'm going to get caught. And then all of a sudden, I started going, I'm going to lose my job, which is the only thing I had, because I didn't have a husband. I didn't have children. I didn't have a mortgage. All I had was my career. I had gone to school from kindergarten till the age of 24. And then I got, I was 30 and I had that job. And I was like, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose the reputation that I have. I mean, because my ego was really big. And I'm like, the week before in the Bakersfield, California, in the metro section, was a big picture of the lady who ran the social services department. They busted her shoplifting at Macy's, and they put her picture on the newspaper. And so my mind went, oh my God, I'm going to get caught drunk driving. I'm going to be in the metro section of the Bakersfield, California, and my family is going to see it, and everybody's going to know. Oh my God. I started crying, and I said, okay, God, I'll go to AA. Just please don't let him stop me. And shoo, he went past me. He wasn't even chasing me. I probably wasn't even speeding, and he was after somebody else. But you know what? God works in mysterious ways. The next day I was in a meeting saying I'm an alcoholic, and that's the best thing that ever happened to me, It really is. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I got busy with the steps, and like I told you, I admitted I was powerless, that I had tried to stop on my own. But, I had heard a man in a meeting say, oh, I can stop drinking. My problem is I can't stay stopped, I can't stay stopped. Eventually I drink again. And I didn't understand why we do that, Well, they told me I didn't have to know why. The old timers tell me, you just have to do these steps, And I was sober a few months, and I was sitting in a Lano club, and somebody came up to me and said, what's wrong? You don't look very happy. And I'm like, I'm not. What the hell? What's this program about? This is going to be it. You come to a meeting on Friday and everybody spits all over the cake, blowing out candles. Then you guys cut it up and hand it out and people eat it with all those germs. And oh, no, this is going to be my Friday nights to the rest of my life. And he goes, have you done those steps? I go, yeah, I did them right there. They're right there on the wall right there. And he goes, yeah, that's exactly how they came out, on the wall, off the wall. You know, he goes, come on. Let's go to your apartment. I'm like, what? And he goes, no, not for anything like that. We're going to do these steps. And he said, you know, step two, you have to come to believe. He goes, first you have to come, which you're here. Then you have to come to, which you've been sober more than 30 days now. So, you know, then you have to come to believe. I go, believe that a power greater than you can restore you to sanity. Let's look at those words. What's restore me? I don't know. Look it up. Right. Brought back to its original condition. Okay. It's going to restore you to sanity. I don't know. Look it up. Balance. It's going to bring you back to balance. This power that's greater than you. And I go, I don't know about that. I don't really, you know, I'm not really religious. I haven't really thought about God. I don't really condone any of came and he conquered, in the name of God, they came and they conquered the Aztecs and they did that to my people. And he says, that's religion. He says, you've got religion confused with spirituality, you know. And I go, I don't know. He goes, all you need is a mustard seed of faith. Little mustard seed. You ever seen a mustard seed? No. Look it up. Tiny, tiny little mustard seed. You just got to be willing to believe. Because you cannot do this program if you're not willing to pick up the kit of spiritual tools. Because if you're not willing to do that, then you go back out there. I go, no, I want to stop drinking. He says, okay, well, will you be willing? I go, okay, I'm willing to give it a try. I'm willing. Okay, that's all you need. The third step, now you need to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of that higher power. And, you know, at first, I just said, well, I'm going to call my higher power creator because I don't know what to call my higher power. And I told this lady in a meeting in the Alana Club. I used to hang around the Alana Club all the time. She said, look, make a list. I need, I want, and I expect. Under each thing, put what you need God, this God to be. I need for him to be honest, to be reliable, to be all the, what do I expect him to be? I expect him to be funny. You know, I expect him to be this. And what do you, the three columns, made me do the three columns. And then after I did that, she says, okay, now say, and for each day you can say, God is funny. God is reliable. God's got my back. God says, I read all of it. She goes, there, you have God. That's your God right there. Like, oh, pretty cool God. I like that God, you know? And now you have to put your life under the care of that higher power. And I liken that too, because, you know, it's hard to understand because it says made a decision, okay? So that's what you're doing. You're making a decision. You're not actually doing it. You're deciding to. And I was liken it to when my ex-husband asked me to marry him. You know, got on one knee, and he said, will you marry me? And I stupidly said, yes. I made a decision. But it didn't mean I was married. I could have changed that mind, which I should have, but I didn't. I made a commitment. I made a decision, you know. I was going to follow through. In order to follow through, I had to do the rest of the things that required. Get a license, get a blood test. Of the things you have to do to get to that point where you walk up and you say, I do. Then you're married. But on step three, I wasn't married. I was just making the decision to turn my will and my life over to hear God. I didn't even know what my will was. I had to look that up too. And then it says, turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Not that you're saying, do everything for me. I'm just saying, I need God to take care of me, to guide me, to do for me what I can't do for myself when I can't find myself able to do things. And I had an understanding of God now from the list she made me do. And the way I likened the idea of being under God's care was like when I had my son, I was in labor forever. And finally the doctor came in, I don't know, hours and hours and hours of labor, and said, "Honey, you gave it the good old college try, but your son's in fetal distress. We need to take him out now." And I go, take him now, you know? And that was me putting my life under the care of that doctor, because I was expecting him to do for me what I couldn't give birth. My son had the cord wrapped around his foot, and it was like a bungee cord. It was going in now, he couldn't come out. And I needed somebody to take care of me, you know, to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's how I understand step three. Is I'm making a decision for that higher power to take care of things that I can't personally take care of by myself. That I need that support and that strength and that power that he has. He or whatever your higher power is. And then he got me to do that fourth step, you know, with the columns, just like it is in the book. And that's where I got to see the errors of all my ways, you know. I put down all the people that I had a resentment towards, that I was angry at, my mom, my dad for leaving me and choosing to be with that witch, you know, that made my mom divorce him when I was 10, and then him choosing her instead of me, you know, my mom for not being there for my dad so he wouldn't have to go out on her, you know, all the stuff, you know, and got it all down. And then when I had to look at my part, then I had to look at what I did, you know. I would hide from my dad when he came to visit me. And, you know, I was belligerent and lied to my mom. I was disrespectful. You know, once I turned into a teenager, I wasn't the nice little girl that I was before, because I got introduced to alcohol and other substances that we won't talk about here at this meeting. But I had to admit all the things, you know, things I did, like when I was in college, you know, lied, cheated, manipulated. I would manipulate my instructors, you know, because I would party and have hangovers. I just couldn't take those tests. I wouldn't pass them. I'd go in the teacher and I'd cry and I'd say, my father died and I just can't concentrate. And I'd cry and make tears come out and oh my God, okay, what can we do? And I go, can I have another week? I think in another week I can do this. And yes, yes, well, you can do that in another week, you know. I passed the test in a week, you know, because I'd study, but I was lying to them. My roommates would say, how could you lie to your teacher? They go, I'm not lying, my dad did die. Yes, but he died in 1972. I'm like, I know, but I didn't tell him when. I'm not really lying. No. And then I needed to pass science. I took science. I think I was on my third round of trying to take science. I could not pass science. I tried geology. I tried astronomy. I tried everything. Somebody said, take physical science. It won't be as hard. And I could not pass it. And I was like, I have to pass this class. I'm not going to graduate. So my instructor decided to leave the room. I guess he went to the bathroom. Remember, I told you I got sober in the 70s, right? I mean, in the 80s, but it was 70s when I was in college. They didn't have computers back then. They had grade books where they would write A, F, D, right? So, and I was at San Diego State, and we were sitting like in a, you know, those seats where they go, I forgot what you call those seats. Yes. And I was at the top, of course, in the back. And I saw the teacher leave, and I just ran down there. I could run back then because I wasn't as big as I am now. I ran down there, and where I had a couple of A's there, I mean F's, I turned them into A's. And I passed. I passed with a C. And nobody snitched. Nobody snitched on me. Can you believe that? I was able to pass that class. And I was a liar. I was a cheat. And I used to steal alcohol. I lived by this liquor store, and it was a round store in San Diego. And I used to go, and I used to stand like that and put pints of liquor in my pond and I'll walk out, you know. But back then they used to chase you, not like now, you know. But I didn't get caught. And I had to realize I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I mean, a lot of other stuff. But one of the things that that really I learned a lot about myself was I was such a liar, you know. I was a liar all the way up, even 10 years of sobriety, I was still lying. I wasn't massively lying, but I went to a meeting in Arroyo Grande, and there was this old man there. He passed away, God rest his soul, now. But I think it was my age that I am now when I was there. And he says, oh, are you new in town? And I go, oh, I just moved here from San Luis Obispo. He says, oh, you're looking for a job? And I go, no, I have a job. I work at Cuesta College. And he goes, are they off today? And I said, no. He says, you're not work? And I go, no, I took the day off. And he goes, I thought I was being sneaky. He goes, I took the day off. And he goes, oh, why? And I go, he goes, are you sick? And I go, no, I'm not sick. It's just called a sick day. He goes, but you're not sick. I go, no. He goes, so you lied. And I go, well, it's kind of like a mental health day. And he goes, are you mentally sick? Are you mentally ill? And I go, well, no. He says, so you lied. And I go, yes, I lied. Do you do that often? He tells me. And I said, well, I tell little lies. Like, you know, I'm usually late. And so, you know, I say like a train passed by and that's why I'm late. He goes, so you lie. You lie. And I go, yes, I lie. And he goes, do you want to stop lying? And I go, yeah. What do I have to do? And he goes, he gets all in my face like that. And he goes, stop lying. So the next day I was late to work because I'm a late person. And I walk in and my boss is sitting there. He's never there. There was covered for me and my staff. And he's sitting there and he looks up at the clock like that when I walked in. And I looked at him and I go, oh, I overslept. And he goes, oh, it happens. And I walked in my office going, God damn, all those times I lie and didn't even care, you know. And so what I did, though, is I had to reflect on how come I lie and what is the root cause of that. And it's fear. Yeah. It's fear. I'm afraid of the consequences. I don't like paying consequences. I don't like, you know, being fired or being told no, or I don't like it. And I realized that I was late and I was oversleeping because I was staying up really late. And I was staying up really late because I wanted to watch movies or do whatever the hell I was doing till 2 a.m. And then it's hard to wake up to get all the way to Cuesta. And I was being selfish and self-centered. I was not considering my students who had to wait for me and then them be late to their class or not have their appointment because I wasn't there in time to see them. I wasn't considering their feelings. I was being, you know, irresponsible. And I had to like do that 4-step all over again, you know, and a 10-step, you know, I had to do it all over again and go, man, you know, and not just lying. It's all the consequences of everything that, why am I lying? Because I want to do what I want to do and I want to do it when I want to do it. I want to do it right goddamn now. And I don't want nobody telling me anything. It's that stubbornness, you know. So I had to confront those things and ask myself if I still want to do it, which brings me now to the sixth step, which is, hey, you want to keep being that person you were? You know, that's what the sixth step tells me. I have to ask myself, do I want to keep being the liar, the cheat, the thief? You know, do I want to keep being dishonest, selfish, and self-centered? Do I want to keep, you know, thinking of myself more than I think of other people? And the answer was no. No, I don't want to be like that. So what I had to do was practice the opposite of those behaviors. So every time I wanted to be dishonest, I had to be honest. Like, I found a microwave at Costco or one of those places, Home Depot somewhere. I found a microwave when I went to put my groceries away. And I said, first thought, shit, I came up. You know, that was my first thought. I came up, look at this microwave. I'm like, oh, I don't even need a microwave. But it's those old patterns of thinking, you know. I'm like, nobody I know needs a microwave. And I'm like, that's that old thinking. You think you came up, you didn't come up, go return it, do the opposite. I took it in. I found this in a cart in the parking lot. The guy goes, you're so honest. A lot of people just would have taken that. And when he said, you're so honest, I kind of felt my head go up and my shoulders go back, and it felt good. It felt good to be looked at as an honest person, you know. I had a sense of integrity, and I liked it, you know. And that happened with all my other negative behaviors. As I practiced the opposite, you know, I used to do a lot of things for people, but I didn't realize that I did it because I wanted accolades. I wanted to be pat on the back. Ever since I was little, I used to like, oh, Janet's a good little helper, and she's so nice, and everybody would pat me on the back, and I needed outside validation. But what I learned here is how to get internal validation. How do I feel good about what I do because it feels good to do it, not because other people tell me that I'm good? And I learned things like that by practicing the opposite of my defects. And that's how I became willing to do step 7, to humbly ask God to remove those things from me, to remove my shortcomings. And then I had to look back on that step 4 and see other people that I thought harmed me and ask myself, you know, part of doing step 3 for me is forgiving those people, you know, because in the third step in the book, it tells you, before you look at your stuff, it says, now we go back and we look at the list and we ask God to save us from being angry. Save me from being, I can't quote it, but save me from being angry. How can I be helpful to this person? Your will not might be done. I have to forgive these people, you know. And I had to forgive them because I saw that I was capable of doing shit that I wanted forgiveness for too. And I had high expectations of people and expecting them to behave the way I thought they should behave. And when they didn't, then I found fault with them. So I had to forgive them for just being human beings, for being who they are, for doing the best they could, like my mom and my dad, and realizing that my mom, you know, she behaved that way, the way she behaved, because her mom died when she was really young, and she didn't have that kind of love and affection, so she didn't know how to be like that, you know? And I had to start looking at why people do the things they do, and I had to forgive them, you know? And that, when I got to the 8th step, and I made the list of people that I had harmed, I became willing to make amends to them, because I realized, you know, by me making amends to somebody, it's gonna free them up, because they're gonna be able to forgive me, maybe. One didn't, but by them forgiving, they don't have to carry around that anger and that resentment towards me anymore. That liberates them. It doesn't really do anything for me, because it liberates them. But humbling myself to have to go tell my friend, I put sugar in your gas tank that time I was drunk, and, you know, I owe you a transmission or whatever it is that I owe you. I took your jewelry, and I was going to return it, but it got stolen from my house, and now I don't know what to do. I'll give you some money, you know, having to tell my brother. You know, that car you loaned me, it got towed, and I never took it out. I think I owe you like $5,000. Can I pay you in payments? You know, all those kinds of amends I had to make. I cussed out a priest. I never got to make amends to him because I procrastinated. But so I went to confession and I told a different priest. And he said, oh, I carried it around for a lot of years. Finally, I told the priest and he says, don't worry about it. That he forgave you the moment you said it. He's a priest. I'm like, oh, I didn't think of that. You know. And so I had to humble myself to admit those things and realize that in doing so, in being able to make those amends, it lifted me. You know, it says we're going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension. That we're going to realize that we're living on a spiritual plane now. You know, and once you do that, you know, there's no feeling like that feeling of finishing step 9. You finish step 9, and you realize you are on a spiritual plane. You know. Because in and of myself, I couldn't have done all that. I had my higher power guided me to do those things, to be able to recognize those things, to show me the truths I needed to see. And, you know, there's no feeling like it. If you haven't done that, if you haven't done your steps to that point, you don't know what it feels like. I would say that feeling is so hard to describe. It's like trying to describe an orgasm. If you haven't had one, you don't know what it feels like, you know? And that's the way step 9 is. If you haven't done that step, you don't know what it feels like. And you don't know what you're missing. You don't know what you're missing. I hope that encourages you to want to do step 9. And you know what I realized, you know, I've been around. I mean, I've been sober for 40 years. It's a long time. Somebody the other day at a meeting, she's been around 46 years, and she goes, it's like going to the gym. She says, you know, you can go to the gym for like 30 days. Try doing it for 40 years. She was 46 years. She goes, try doing it for 46 years. And I'm like, yeah, you know. But the reason it's possible to do this is because you get so much out of it. You know, it's not just not drinking. And now I use 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. I continue. All that step work up that we do up there is to prepare us. To me, I call it boot camp. It's the boot camp of AA because it prepares you to do 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. That you just learn to do it. I learned to do it automatically. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. You know, throughout the day, I check myself, you know. In the morning, I always do a third step prayer when I wake up. Well, as soon as I open my eyes, I do that. So I'm like constantly turning my will over to the care of God. And then I look at what's going on. Like, I have been out of sorts for days. I have been depressed, and I don't want to call it depression because that's clinical. I've been sad, you know. The reason I'm sad is because 2 years ago, on December the 4th, as I was getting my Christmas tree ready for Christmas and my son to come home from college, I got a phone call that he was at a basketball game at the Golden One Center in Sacramento, and that he had lost consciousness and that the paramedics were trying to revive him. And I got in my car immediately and drove there. And halfway there, I got news that he didn't make it. So this time of the year is really difficult for me, you know, because I'm still grieving that loss. And it's even worse, made worse now because of my surgery and all the medications I had to take. And I had to do double antibiotics and painkillers. And it's all in my system and I can't get it out, you know. But because I do that step, I check myself all day long, you know. Well, what do I have to do? I have to do the next indicated thing. I have to get my ass out of that bed, even though I don't feel like getting out of that bed. And I have to get in that shower, and I have to take a shower. And I have to pick up my clothes. And I have to do 3 things that day, whether it be hanging up my clothes, doing some laundry. I get to, go, you know, whatever I need to wash the dishes, feed myself, go to a meeting, you know, because that's where I'm going to get fed. That's where I'm gonna hear what I need to hear. I'm gonna get hugs. I'm gonna get, you know, people who love me and support me. And I'm gonna be supportive of people too, because there's gonna be people and they're going through something worse than I am. Now, I also have to make proper amends. Like that mortgage guy called me, tell me that I hadn't paid my mortgage. I paid my mortgage. It's on my statement, you know? And I'm like, I already paid it. I already told you. You know, I normally don't behave that way, but I caught myself. And he says, ma'am, if you're going to talk like that to me on the phone, we should just end this conversation. And as much as I hated to say it, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm just being very passionate right now. It's just that I paid $4,000 and you're telling me I haven't paid my mortgage. And it's right here on my bank statement. Well, it was probably sent to the wrong place. I'm like, okay, give me the phone number to where I have to call, and I'll call them tomorrow. You know, but I was yelling at the guy, you know, but I have to promptly make amends because that's not right. I'm not supposed to be treating people that way for whatever reason. And I get to do that because I follow this program, you know. And when I wake up in the morning, I pray, like at step 11. Thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. And today I have a different understanding of God. I have actually returned back to my faith as a child, and I don't agree with everything that the religion does shows, but I agree with everything that my higher power has to say on the subject of these things: love, harmony, truth, faith, hope, light, joy, all that stuff. That's what I believe in, and that happens to be the teachings of some of the people that I follow. And I seek that knowledge, and I seek that assurance, and knowing that my higher power is going to carry me through everything, you know. Friday, I was really out of sorts. I was sitting outside, and one of my sponsees comes up. We were going to go to a meeting at noon. She came at 10. She goes, "Am I too early?" I go, "No, you're not early enough. Come in. Come here." And, you know, I go, "I need to hear your problems because I don't want to focus on mine." And, you know, we just chatted and talked, and it was just, God just works that way for me. He sends people that I need to talk to come and share. And, you know, I told her, you know, it's just about this feeling I have. It too shall pass. This too shall pass. It's not going to last forever. It's going to pass, you know. I just have to keep doing what I do. I have to practice these principles in all my affairs, you know. And I have had that spiritual awakening, which to me is a whole shift in perspective. If you look up a miracle, the shift in perspective. You know, it tells us that we're going to have a spiritual awakening, and that we're going to look at things from a whole different perspective and a way of running our life. And, you know, the design for living is in this book. And if I ever have anything that I just can't seem to get grasp, I open this book up. The messages are always there. I have sponsees. I try to share my experience, strength, and hope with them. I go to meetings. You know, I don't have a commitment because I'm still very irresponsible. I'm working on it. It's going to take me another 40 years, but whatever. But I do, I'm available to anybody in AA. Anytime the hand of AA reaches out, I'm there 24 hours a day, you know. It's just part of what I do. I want to read a couple of things that are favorite things for me in the book. And if you bear with me, I have a few more minutes left. Says right here, this is part of a book called, a story called Twice Gifted. There's just some few sentences that I really like. I guess I didn't tell you some, I've gone through a lot of stuff in sobriety. I never get to how things are now. In sobriety, I got to leave that alcoholism program and have a son. I met somebody in AA who promptly, when my son was 4 days old, left me to be a single mom. And 5 years later, after staying home with him, I got a job at Cuesta College. After like 5 interviews at different places, God sent me here. Thank God I didn't get those jobs in Bakersfield. I got to come to the Central Coast and work at Cuesta College for almost 40 years. And in 2012, because I felt like I drank a lot during my first master's program, I went and got another master's program. I did another master's. I was going to do a PhD, but my then husband decided he liked my best friend better than me. So he left me after I helped him get through school, which, you know, karma's terrible because he ended up going back out and passing away. I met somebody else, and 9 months later, he had a heart attack and he passed away. And then I had to have heart surgery. I had quadruple bypass. This year I had brain surgery and I had a hip replacement. So a lot of things happen in sobriety. And for me, that's why it's important to stay spiritually fit. That's why it's important to practice 10, 11, 12 after you've done all the steps. Because if you're not spiritually fit, when shit like that happens, you're not going to know what to do. And the old thought of taking that drink, it's going to sound appealing, you know. So it says here, my physical being has certainly undergone a transformation, but the major transformation has been spiritual. The hopelessness has been replaced by abundant hope and sincere faith. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous have provided a haven where I remain, where if I remain aware and keep my mind quiet enough, my higher power leads me to amazing realizations. I find joy in the daily life, in being of service, in simple beings, in simply being. I have found rooms full of wonderful people like all of you. And for me, each and every one of the big book promises have come true. The things that I have learned from my own experience, from the big book, and from my friends in AA, patience, acceptance, honesty, humility, and true faith in a power greater than myself, are the tools I use today to live my life, this precious, And I always quote this part of the big book at the end of my pitch. It's from The Keys to the Kingdom. And he says 15 years, but I'm going to say 40. The last 40 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, all of you, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as these years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with each other, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.
Let's give Janet another round of applause. Thank you, Janet, so much for speaking tonight. Anybody who would like to come up after the meeting to thank her is more than welcome to.